It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore objects and documents, photos from the turn of the 20th century connected to the pharmaceutical trade, drug manufacturing, and early pharmacies, and how these pieces help to enlighten healthcare debates today. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Hannah Swan is archivist at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, contributes to the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. Hannah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. And along with you is Lucas Rickert, historian of medicine and pharmacy, newly named executive director of the Institute. Luke, welcome to you.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Luke, let's start with you. You teach this class on history of pharmacy, which was offered at UW-Madison for the first time more than a century ago. So there's a long history there. Why is pharmacy's history relevant today?
Yeah, it's really exciting. Pharmacy and drugstores have been built into the fabric of American business and culture really since the beginning of the United States. And so, you know, the pharmacy has been incredibly important in the history of the country. It's been a gathering spot. It's been a civic hub. It's a place where you get a soda from the soda fountain or a coffee or go meet friends. But obviously, it's also a place where you get health counseling, and it's end of the pharmaceutical supply chain. So it has had this multiple sort of multiple roles in our history.
And you're walking in footsteps. Talk about the people who pioneered the history of pharmacy at the UW.
Sure. Yeah. So over 100 years ago, professors like myself, much better dressed, wearing suits and top hats and so on, decided that it was really important that pharmacists and people in the health sciences got exposed to the humanities and the arts. And so getting that sort of holistic education around history and other disciplines, they thought was super important. So they created history of pharmacy classes, and they helped create the American Institute for the History of Pharmacy. And this is kind of the tradition that Hannah and I are stewarding right now.
Hannah, as an archivist, how does this history influence pharmacy today? What are the connections you're making as you go so deeply into the holdings of the Institute?
Sure. So, you know, I think for me, I don't have a background in, you know, histories of science or history of medicine. And I think it's been really illuminating as I go through to think about the ways in which this does all connect to our contemporary moment. And I think once you kind of start to think about things pharmaceutically, it pops up everywhere. You know, all over the news right now, everything from, you know, debates around Ozempic and weight loss medicine to things like over-the-counter hearing aids, to, you know, these kind of really big debates right now around birth control, medical abortion access, and, you know, narcotic and opiate use. When I look at, you know, the archive, I'm seeing how, you know, these contemporary debates have been formed through centuries of, you know, similar debate around access, around use, around, you know, laws and regulation. So for me, it's been really fascinating to kind of connect with contemporary collecting, historical collecting, and the records that we have here.
And do you think those old debates come through in the ephemera, in these marketing and advertising pieces, or is it through other parts of the collection? Where do you see those early debates?
Sure. So there's all kinds of records in the collection. So this is actually a pretty unique archive in the sense that, you know, the more traditional sense would be either a business archive where you're really having, you know, the records of the activity of a certain company, or a more manuscript, you know, family history based archive where you're seeing things like correspondence and family papers. But this is really a print based archive, which is what drew, you know, me to the position, actually. This is kind of my area of specialty. And I find that, you know, although there are these kind of more traditional records, like we have the correspondence of Edward Kremers, who's the man who founded the collection. He was the second director of the School of Pharmacy from 1893 to 1935, I believe. Luke can correct me if I'm wrong. But you also have, you know, this really robust, interesting advertising and journal-based history. So, you know, some of the things that I'm looking at, you know, when we're thinking about, you know, the Comstock Act, for example, coming back up in our contemporary moment, we have materials not only around the kind of court cases that were coming up in the early 20th century around the sale of contraceptives and birth control, but also, you know, these kind of like illicit mailings that were being sent technically illegally by companies. And then we actually have correspondence around that. One of my favorite pieces to kind of pull out is a letter that a professor here at UW-Madison actually wrote to the United States Post Office reporting one of the companies that was basically soliciting contraceptive sales by mail. And then this kind of back and forth about, you know, thank you so much for pointing this out to us. Turns out that he had a friend who worked for a kind of rival rubber company. So, you know, you have all this kind of intrigue and, you know, looking at how, the kind of day-to-day people are involved in these broader debates, if that makes sense.
Yes, Hannah Swan with us and Luke Rickert. They are with the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy based at UW-Madison. As we talk about the history of pharmacy, how it resonates today, you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Lucas, Hannah brings an example of connecting the then to the now. What is the reaction from pharmacists during birth control bans of the past and how it connects to issues today?
Yeah, really good question. It's important to note that there's incredible diversity within the pharmacist population across the United States, and that all pharmacists take an oath about how they're going to serve their patients. And this oath that all the pharmacists take here at UW is to protect their patients to the best of their ability. That being said, some of the discussions around access to certain drugs is impacting the way in which pharmacists are working in different stores. So there's pressures from anti-abortion groups, for example, just to go back to this earlier conversation that you were having, to restrict pharmacists' ability to prescribe and dispense abortion medications. And so this is not, a singular kind of example. I mean, there have been pressure on pharmacists for hundreds of years to modify their practice and sort of sometimes restrict and sometimes expand the role that they have in the healthcare system in the United States. So that's maybe a rambly answer, Kate, but I suppose what I wanted to suggest to you is that pharmacists have a really important and complicated role in healthcare in the United States, and one that sort of evolved over time. And the archives that we have at the AIHP helped to illuminate and shed light on some of the sort of longstanding debates in the profession.
And it really relates back to the heartbeat of the community, pharmacies being in the center of the community as well, I would imagine.
Well, that's absolutely it. I mean, pharmacists play an integral role in sort of the fabric of American society, not just healthcare. I mean, there are Norman Rockwell paintings around the pharmacist store, right? I mean,
Yes.
there's like quintessential Americana that sort of has to do with, going down to the drugstore, popping in and getting yourself a soda. So, what we are hoping to do at the Institute is interrogate and sort of explain some of this history and then connect it to These debates in the present moment around opioids and vaccines, birth control medicines, and a lot of it has to do with digitizing some of our materials and making it more findable by the public so that the public has access to some of these records.
Luke Ricker with us from the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. Hannah Swan, archivist in this library located in the basement of the building that houses the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. Be part of this conversation about pharmaceutical artifacts and history. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the work of a nationwide historical society at UW-Madison. Its collections include ephemera documenting pharmacy in our nation from 1890 to the present. Join in on the evolution of pharmacies, drug manufacturing and marketing, past and present. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Luke Rickard is a UW-Madison School of Pharmacy professor and executive director of the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. And Hannah Swan is here, archivist and contributor to the Institute. We had Sandy from Lake Geneva, who is wondering, what is the difference, Luke, between a pharmacy and an apothecary? Can you explain the distinction?
Sure, I can absolutely do my best. I think that probably the best way of thinking around the apothecary versus the pharmacy has to do with the UK, United Kingdom, and the United States. And so the apothecary really is a remnant of the UK and England and Scotland. And sort of that was sort of the nomenclature, that was the terminology that was used over there that got transferred over to the United States with the founding of the country. When you think about the roots of pharmacy in the United States, you really have to think through these first sort of apothecary shops that had a lot to do with colonialism. And often these apothecary shops had physicians in them rather than pharmacists. So it was the physicians who ran these apothecary shops. That changes over time. So you're starting to see sort of a gradual sort of diversification of this business model in the United States, where you're going away from strictly the apothecary shop towards general stores, druggists, the drugstore. And then later, the pharmacy as we know it. So that's kind of the short answer.
Let's turn to advertising. And Hannah, I want to listen to some sound. And this is pharmaceutical commercials, one of them, you know, explaining the myriad side effects and the warnings. And let's hear the type 2 diabetes commercial for Jardiance.
Jardiance may cause serious side effects, including ketoacidosis that may be fatal, dehydration that can lead to sudden worsening of kidney function, and genital yeast or urinary tract infections. A rare life-threatening bacterial infection in the skin of the perineum could occur. Stop taking Jardiance and call your doctor right away if you have symptoms of this infection, ketoacidosis, or an allergic reaction. And don't take it if you're on dialysis.
Okay, so Hannah, I mean, the list goes on. Do you see similar styles of advertising in the archives as you would in this Jardiance commercial?
Sure. So, you know, as things progress in the 20th century, yes, but certainly back in the day, they would not have been listing all of these side effects. You know, until you get the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act, that really starts to regulate what you know, that you have to accurately label your drugs. A lot of these, you know, things that legally now people are required to disclose would not have been anywhere
They
in
might
the
not even been
advertising.
known yet, right?
Yeah, exactly. The kind of wide scale, you know, testing that you need
Sure.
to identify these. But you know, it's funny to look back at some of the, you know, definitely questionable drugs that were being advertised. And you know, the fact that there aren't any kind of contradictions, or you know, they're saying, oh, well, if you know, if you give this, you know, narcotic to your child, just give them a little bit and they'll be fine, you know. And just to think about how much that's changed. Luke, I don't know if you have other things to add,
Look,
as far
go
as side
ahead.
effects.
Yes, go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, I mean that's a funny ad that you played for the listeners, the song and dance that everyone's doing. I guess I would just say that you know, just backing up a little bit, that direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceuticals kind of makes our country unique. The United States is one of only a couple countries in the world that allows this kind of direct-to-consumer advertising. And you know, companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars on advertising to the public, and that's a way of recouping their investment in a given drug. And so we're, you know, sometimes we're bombarded with advertisements around prescription and non-prescription drugs. And I always get a bit of a laugh, and I'm sure many people do, when, you know, there's that sort of long list of all the things that can harm you with the given product. You know, I'll just say too that, you know, these adverts, sometimes when you look at the archives at the Institute, and some of the materials that we have online, have been like pretty funny, but also kind of problematic as well. There have been instances where, you know, you have certain sort of appropriation of different groups to try and sell medicines. And we have one exhibit at the AIHP around Native and Indigenous imagery in pharmaceutical advertising that is freely available to the public if they're trying to understand the ways in which different cultural groups have been used in attempting to sell patent medicines and different types of drugs.
Luke Rickert there is Executive Director of the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. Hannah Swan, Archivist at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Dave in Madison is here. Dave, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, my name is Dave. I'm a retired pharmacist now. I graduated in the 1970s at the UW. And I studied history of pharmacy, of course. It was a required course then. I understand it isn't now, which is a travesty. I studied with Dr. Glenn Sonnebecker, who we referred to fondly as Sonny Glenn, because he was always so bright and cheerful. There was never a professor that worked harder to engage us with every modern technology, audio tapes, slideshows, music, and I very fondly remember my history of pharmacy, and also in practice, and I practiced for more than 40 years. I never used any course as much as I use the history of pharmacy. It's just so valuable.
Why is that? Why was that?
Well, you know, when you're talking with patients and you're engaging with them and consulting, to know the history of the medicines that you're taking, or the history of the trajectory of medicine, you know, it's just enormously valuable to have that perspective, that long perspective, and also to be able to look forward to realize, you know, medicine changes a lot, and you see that especially in history. You don't have to go back very far to see some pretty dramatic changes. So.
Dave, thank you. Yes, thank you for those thoughts. Luke, what comes up for you?
Well, what comes up is it's just amazing to hear Dave's comments, honestly. I'm so glad that he phoned in to say that because, yeah, he's absolutely right in suggesting that it's no longer a mandatory course for pharmacists, as much as I think that it ought to be a mandatory course, because I think that ultimately, the founders of the history of pharmacy tradition here in Madison, and across the state had it right that we should be offering a holistic understanding of healthcare and putting some of these medicines that are sort of widely available now in a larger sort of framework and context. So it's fantastic to hear from Dave.
Historian Luke Rickert is a UW-Madison professor, executive director of the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. Hannah Swan, archivist and contributor to the Institute. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the documentation and preservation of pharmacy's heritage and the digitization work underway at a nationwide historical society based at UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. Call in with a question. Share thoughts about the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have its executive director, Luke Rickert, here, and archivist Hannah Swan. Hannah, Luke was talking about the Institute's work in examining the misappropriation of indigenous imagery on pharmaceutical advertising. And what messages does this exhibit raise for you and what it highlights? Go ahead.
Sure. So I will say that the exhibit was done before my tenure here. It was done by my colleague, Beth Fisher, who's the curator here at the Institute. So I think for me, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot as I've come in, I started in my position in September, is that as much as this is this really rich archive of, pharmacy history, it very much reflects the people who were collecting. And so, you know, when we have materials like this, we're looking at a very, you know, kind of dominant culture view of, you know, indigenous cultures and kind of, you know, again, appropriating their imagery to sell drugs. I think especially, you know, this idea of kind of purity and naturalness being conveyed through these advertisements. I think looking ahead and looking at our contemporary collecting, as well as collecting we can do in the historical period, one of the really important things is to kind of round out the collection and to look at where are these gaps that exist and whose voices are not being represented. And so for me, you know, looking at the exhibit, it very much, you know, talks through how, you know, these materials were produced and why and by whom. But then from my perspective, looking at, you know, again, how can we make this more holistic?
Right. I mean, the profession historically dominated by white men. And I think what you're speaking to here, hoping to recognize pharmacists who are female and people of color. How do you do this type of work as you try to sort through and organize all of the collections and then also make it accessible?
Sure. So right now I'm in the midst of processing the collection. So kind of in layperson's terms, that would mean going through, I am going to basically touch every piece of paper that exists in the archive and make sure that it is where it should be so that everything is organized. Every folder has a unique identifier so that it's much easier for me and for research to access these materials. And so as I do that, I try to think about, you know, what am I seeing here? What is represented? And then, you know, who is not being represented? And so, you know, one of the things that I've been doing is looking at, you know, what can we collect around women, around people of color, communities of color, You know, a good example would be, you know, thinking about ephemera. Oftentimes, because, you know, for those of you, I guess it occurs to me that, you know, for those of you who don't know what ephemera is, you know, Maurice Ricard's defined it as the minor transitory documents of everyday life. Mm-hmm. So these are going to be low cost materials, very much democratic. And so when we're looking at these materials, they often will represent communities that have been historically marginalized, who didn't have access to kind of dominant printing technologies. And so, you know, one of the things that I've recently collected, for example, would be an almanac, a medical almanac from 1949, that actually has these amazing ads for hair care products for Black women. And, you know, they have these great photographs. And, you know, these are in literally in the margins of a marginal print item. So, you know, it's very much these kind of ephemeral traces that you need to be able to draw out when you're looking at these more kind of dominant narratives.
Let's bring on another call. Alicia in Milwaukee, or Alicia, I'm sorry, sure. In Milwaukee. Alicia, go ahead.
That's fine. Hi. I was just wondering if anyone had reached out to Mr. Claiborne Benson at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society here in Milwaukee. He had some information. I'm a pharmacist, and he had just told me at the Juneteenth celebration here in Milwaukee about a pharmacist that was in the early 1900s that I had no knowledge of. And I was too loud and too busy to get the full story. But making those connections and putting pieces together about the diversity of pharmacy is very important as you're trying to reach back and plug in some pieces as to why this happened and that happened. So that's something I think that's helpful. And also reaching out to the people who had previously taken care of Dr. Lester Carter's pharmacy to see if he had any artifacts as well.
Alicia, thank you so much. Luke, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a brilliant suggestion. Haven't reached out in those directions just yet, but I mean, I think this is precisely the kind of buy-in that the Institute requires to move forward in the future and to provide the sort of infrastructure and to provide the sort of foundation for Hannah and others who are collecting at the Institute. So I just want to thank you for phoning in.
Luke, how do you add to the collection, and what is your relationship to other schools of pharmacy around the country and the world? What is the network like?
Right. So there is an international network. It's called the International Society for the History of Pharmacy, and the AIHP is a member. It's a national member of this international body. Within the United States, the AIHP has a number of pharmacy school members, and we're trying to enhance those kinds of connections. We're also trying to enhance connections with individual pharmacists, like the individuals who have already phoned in today. You know, part of what we want to do and what Hannah has been mentioning, you two have been talking amazingly about this, is sort of get intellectual control over what we have. So the collections that we've got, you know, stretch back to the 1880s, 1890s, and what's really important is to have a sense of an inventory, I suppose, for lack of a better term, and then that's going to enable us to sort of figure out what areas precisely we should be collecting in the future, what kind of gaps there are, like Hannah said, where we should be sort of focusing our efforts, if you will.
We're talking about the history of pharmacy, how it resonates today with the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy, Executive Director Luke Rickert with us, Hannah Swan in archives, deep in archives. You could join in with your questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Hannah, I'm curious, as you go through all of these materials, what stands out to you by way of photographs? Because I know there were thousands of black and white photos in your collection commissioned by Drug Topics, the magazine, from the 1940s to the early 70s. And I'm just wondering how you've approached the photos in your efforts.
Sure. So, yeah, we have this amazing Drug Topics collection. So I believe in 1974, Drug Topics magazine, which is kind of one of the big pharmacy magazines that exists, donated their entire photo morgue to us. So we have really this comprehensive look at what was being, you know, photographed and represented in the magazine. And we actually are really lucky. We're partnered with the UW Digital Collection Center. And so we actually have an agreement with them where they are digitizing the majority of those photos for us. And so we already have two rounds, I believe, of photos online, which is, you know, really amazing to be able to make these accessible, full metadata, fully searchable. And the collections are just fabulous. You know, some of my favorite sections would have to be pharmacy beauty queens. So back in the day,
what?
You know, this pharmacy 1952, and, you know, and we have these amazing photos of these women with their sashes, and, you know, and then blurbs on the back about who they were and what pharmacy they worked at. But, you know, we also have a lot of, you know, again, diversity of representation of pharmacists all over the country from, you know, kind of all different walks of life, rural, you know, city, et cetera. You know, for me, I actually am pretty lucky in that I don't really have to do much with the Drug Topics photos as far as processing. They came to us topically arranged and, you know, in the order that the Drug Topics magazine had them. Mm-hmm. And so that makes my life easy. We have an inventory. It's pretty much fully accessible. And that's a really popular collection with researchers.
Luke, how do you hope people use the digital collection?
Well, as much as possible. I mean, I absolutely want people to, you know, put their thinking caps on and maybe get their researchers' pens and pads out and really dig into the history of pharmaceuticals and pharmacy, because this is an area I care deeply about. And I think it has tremendous resonance into the present moment. And so we have these amazing photographs, but then thousands of pages of basically trade catalogs that have been digitized as well, stretching back to the early 20th century, that sort of casts a light onto business culture in the United States, casts a light on all sorts of different research topics. So I think there's lots of avenues for people to explore with these newly digitized materials.
We've talked about the paper pieces and the photos, but, you know, pharmaceutical companies, they also had their freebie trinket products, their promotional things. Do you have those types of, like, pens and keychains and other stuff that are a relic of the pharmaceutical companies?
Absolutely. And maybe Hannah can say about one of the exhibits we have up.
Yeah, so we actually have a couple exhibit cases on the first floor of Rennebaum Hall. And one of the exhibits right now is all about exactly that, pharmaceutical giveaways. So we have, you know, everything from, I think there's a stress ball shaped like a pancreas to, you know, clocks to, you know, a Viagra tie, I believe. You know, kind of all these different giveaways that pharmaceutical companies produce.
Archivist Hannah Swan and Executive Director Luke Rickert of the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy, nonprofit historical society based at UW-Madison, call in with questions and comments about the history of pharmacy. What comes up for you? The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We tour collections and artifacts of the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy and how their holdings that date back to the turn of the century, thereabouts, how they connect to healthcare debates today. Join in with a question, add a comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Archivist Hannah Swan and Institute Executive Director Luke Rickert, they are here. Luke, the Commonwealth Fund reports about 6% of American retail prescription drug sales are completed at independent pharmacies, and 40% of sales happen at retail chains. How have consumer options for buying pharmaceuticals, how have they changed over time?
Ooh, good question, Kate. Thanks for asking that one. That's a good one. I mean, I suppose a couple things have happened. You begin to see more consolidation and fewer independent pharmacies, really from the 1960s onwards to the present moment, and that has a lot to do with pharmacist professional identity as well changing. So I'll break it down this way. What you've begun to see is the compounding pharmacist, the pharmacist who works and creates the medicine themselves, has sort of gone away as you've seen the rise of vertically integrated pharmaceutical firms that are supplying these stores. So that sort of the pharmacist who was at the bench with the mortar and the pestle and all the materials and grinding them up and putting together them into creating a capsule and then dispensing that kind of went away. And what happened is pharmacists, again, from the 60s to the present moment, have been more in the business of dispensing and sort of pharmaceutical counseling and essentially selling rather than the making of the medicines. And that sort of wrap up this little answer is sort of one of the key factors in the consolidation of the industry.
But what has happened to the function of compounding? Is it no longer needed in medicines? Why is it so phased out?
No, I mean, there's definitely hospital pharmacies and compounding pharmacists that are still operating across the United States, but definitely at a much diminished sort of percentage of the overall sort of pharmacy profession. And so, I mean, I definitely don't want to say that compounding has gone away entirely, but that skill set is less emphasized in pharmacy schools now. And you're also seeing, and, you know, maybe this isn't directly to your question, but a little bit more pharmacist fatigue these days. You're getting stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post about trained pharmacists showing a little bit of dissatisfaction and disillusionment with working in certain chain store pharmacies rather than in other sectors of the economy. And so there are a lot of factors right now in contemporary society around pharmacists. We already mentioned some of the big debates around drugs earlier.
Let's bring in Bill in Fitchburg. Bill, hi. What would you like to ask about?
Hi. When I was a kid in the 50s, I used to work in a drugstore, sweeping out and whatnot. And I also worked in a projection booth of a movie theater. And in the drugstore, I think especially, they had big balls of decorative things. And I was told it was full of carbon tetrachloride. In case it got too hot, it would put the fire out. Then I was told that if it did, it was poison. So I wonder what the truth about carbon tetrachloride is.
Bill, thank you. Luke, can you share? Do you have insights?
Oh, what a great question that is about the actual composition of the liquid in some of these pharmacy globes. I'm not sure if I can answer Bill's question with 100% accuracy, but I do know that some of them were made up of the materials he said. But whether or not they were used for putting out fires is another. I'm not sure if that's old wives' tale or what. But I mean, that's one I think I need to dig into a little more. I like that question.
Hannah, you know, today people recognize pharmacists as having the ability to administer vaccines like the flu and COVID vaccines. Have pharmacists always been able to provide immunizations?
Sure. So I definitely think that there is a long history of, you know, pharmacies and vaccinations. I'm not so familiar with, I guess, kind of pre-20th century vaccine campaigns. But we do have some really great, again, photographic materials around the history of vaccines. Luke, I don't know if you can speak to that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, pharmacists, there's been a back and forth about whether or not they should be mobilized to be doing vaccinations. Mm-hmm. And this is something that happens at the state level more often than not. I mean, one of the huge success stories of COVID, if mm-hmm. we can call it that, is the ways in which pharmacists were brought into the fold. And really the sort of the frontline providers of vaccinations, which is something that, you know, a lot of state level governments had to sort of build into the pharmacist workflow. And then not only that, I'll just say that we got students from UW-Madison, other pharmacy schools mobilized as well to be out there providing vaccinations. And what we've done at the Institute is try and chronicle a little bit of that effort. And so if listeners are interested in sharing with the Institute some of this, some of the activities around this, we'd love to hear from you.
That's right. You're trying to preserve pharmacy stories during COVID pandemic, because after all, you're a historical society. And so you're really having to look at the pandemic as this moment.
Oh, I mean, 100%, you know, 100% that. And so, you know, we need to hear from our constituents. We need to hear from people out there to help share and chronicle these really important moments in the history of pharmacy and pharmaceuticals.
Well, Hannah and Lucas, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hannah Swan, archivist at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy and contributor to the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. Luke Rickert, historian of medicine and pharmacy, executive director of the Institute. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.